You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Ayn Rand's Philosophy for Living on Earth, Part 2, by Ben Baer.
So I want to start by saying I'm really impressed that I have such a turnout from people who spent the previous day celebrating life and freedom and who are now here to learn about depravity and death. And I mean, it's an interesting question as to why one would want to come and learn about such a topic and why it is that Galt spends a huge chunk of his speech discussing it. I don't know, for my part, I'm one of the weirdos who likes to look at car crashes when I'm driving by on the highway, causing then the gaper's delay. I like to read Dostoevsky. But there is value in understanding the psychology of evil. If for no other reason than that, well, I mentioned yesterday that Ankar Gatte has argued that Atlas Shrugged, and particularly Galt's speech, is a kind of second declaration of independence. And I said that it would come out more today about why that is. We talked about the morality of life yesterday. We talked about the positive ideals that Galt articulates. But today is where we get to understand better what it is he's declaring independence from, and how, and why. And it's my view that this material in Galt's speech is underappreciated by fans of Ayn Rand and by objectivists. In part, it's because it's very difficult. It's difficult to get through psychologically for yourself if you're not into depravity studies. But it's also difficult because it's highly sophisticated and brings in a lot of psychology. And I'm going to try today to clarify it a little bit. There's a lot, again, that I'm not going to be able to discuss, but I do want to try to show some high-level points and their various interconnections. So yesterday, I started out by reading the passage about how Galt describes the world as in a state of moral crisis. And I pointed out, well, there's a difference between his world and ours, but in this crisis, in this state of crisis, he does ask, well, I also read to you a question that Francisco asks of Reardon, which I think is one that applies to many people today. Your virtues were those which kept men alive. Your own moral code, the one you lived by but never stated, acknowledged, or defended, was the code that preserves man's existence. If you were punished for it, what was the nature of those who punished you? Yours was the code of life. What then is theirs? What standard of value lies at its root? What is its ultimate purpose? And one thing that I want to suggest is that figuring out the answer to this question is also going to help us understand something about our own world today. I had showed you these two graphs from Steven Pinker, the disparity between the way intellectuals look at the world, this decreasing news tone, increasing pessimism at the New York Times, compared to the actual abundance, increasing abundance materially in the state of the world. Remembering again that sometimes part of the reason why people complain about this is because they have concerns about rising inequality. What standard of value is it that motivates that assessment of the world? I think the answer to that question is going to be similar to the answer to Francisco's question about what is their code and what standard of value lies at its root. So if you know yesterday we talked about the morality of life, it's not going to be a big surprise what the complement, what the antithesis to that is going to be. And I'll just go right ahead, jump in, and give you Galt's answer. But the work is going to come in explaining this answer. Here's what he says. You dart in panic through the trap of your days, looking for the exit you have closed, running from a pursuer you dare not name to a terror you dare not acknowledge. And the greater your terror, the greater your dread of the only act that could save you, thinking. The purpose of your struggle is not to know, not to grasp or name or hear the thing. I shall now state to your hearing that yours is the morality of death. So this is his preview of his answer to Francisco's question. Now, I think Francisco knows the answer when he's asking it of Reardon. He's asking it as a rhetorical question. But giving this answer is going to require a lot of explanation. It's going to require some evidence. Because certainly the people who believe in conventional morality, people who believe in the morality of sacrifice, which is most people in the world, certainly don't think of themselves as holding a morality of death. And it would be a big surprise to them to discover that. Indeed, Galt is saying they want to hide this fact from themselves, or that they need to hide this fact from themselves. So what is his reason for thinking this? He gives an abundance of evidence. And for the time being, I want to highlight at least some of the important evidence that he gives. I think the biggest piece is something yet to come that I'm going to develop. But let me at least give you some condensed points of the major pieces of evidence that he offers for why the morality of self-sacrifice is the morality of death. Well, one point is that so much of it and so many of its advocates seem to be motivated more by fear of a negative than by love for a positive. They're concerned more with avoiding suffering than they are with achieving joy. And this connects back to some of the things that we discussed yesterday about existence and identity and how all things that exist have specific identity, including living things and especially including human beings. Remember, life is an active process. If you freeze yourself, you're killing yourself, even though your body remains in existence. And there are spiritual equivalents of that, like trying to seek nirvana. I mean, you can avoid lots of negatives by just freezing yourself. But that doesn't mean that you're achieving a positive, and certainly not the positive of actual living, which means engaging in actual specific activities and processes. So when you think that life is just the avoidance of a morgue, this is a kind of evading of the identity of life. The morality of sacrifice usually just treats as synonymous with morality the idea of whatever is not for the self. It sees morality as a negation of the self. Why would that show that it's the morality of death? Well, think for a moment about what the self is. And this is something we discussed some when we were looking at Rourke's speech and at the Fountainhead. And the self is the thing that thinks and judges and feels and acts. The self is the thing, it's the major tool of life. It's the mind. So if it's anti-self, it's anti-mind. That's something we're going to expand on a little bit more. Now, of course, a lot of advocates of the morality of sacrifice are going to say, but look, we are trying to achieve something positive. What would they say that they're trying to achieve? You're sacrificing yourself, but for what? For others, they'll say. That's the positive, right? But then take a look at what it is about the others that this morality is so motivated by. Galt spends a significant amount of time talking about, well, it's sacrifice for the others who are needy, who are poor, who are ignorant, who are sick, people who lack something, people who lack some ability or value or virtue. And so it's, again, an emphasis on a negative. And it's not aimed at lifting these people up to achieve their best abilities. It's at best usually associated with kind of bringing them up out of the hole, you know, onto neutral ground. And that takes us back to the point about avoiding suffering as opposed to achieving joy, motivation by fear as opposed to love. Last point that I'll mention, though, again, there's one big point left to come that I'm going to develop. And often, Galt points out, advocates of this morality will say, well, look, when we talk about sacrifice, we're only talking about sacrificing your body. It's the body that's evil. And the spirit's another thing. So there's a whole discussion in Galt's speech of the mind-body dichotomy that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Of course, Galt points out, well, look, I mean, the best way to negate your body, the best way to rid yourself of its evil is, of course, to die. But again, there's a big comeback that advocates of the morality of death have. How are they going to explain that their morality, even if it means negating the body, that doesn't mean that what it's seeking is death? What would they say it is seeking? Life eternal unto death. Yeah, and there are several different versions of this. Galt spends a significant amount of time discussing this sort of comeback, and the fact that it's a comeback at all, he thinks, is a further confession to something that we have to learn about the psychology behind the advocates of the morality of death. So let me show you, I think, a really important and underappreciated passage on this topic. It's a longer one, and I tried to cut this one down, but at the end, I couldn't do it because there was too much in here that was important. They claim that they perceive a mode of being superior to your existence on this earth. The mystics of spirit, the religionists, call it another dimension, which consists of denying dimensions. The mystics of muscle, this is the socialists, the Marxists, the materialists, they call it the future, which consists of denying the present. So it's not just the religious advocates of this morality, but even the secular ones. To exist is to possess identity, something we talked about a lot yesterday. What identity are they able to give to their superior realm? They keep telling you what it is not, but they never tell you what it is. All their identifications consist of negating. God is that which no human mind can know, they say, and proceed to demand that you consider it knowledge. God is non-man, heaven is non-earth, soul is non-body, virtue is non-profit, A is non-A, perception is non-sensory, knowledge is non-reason. Their definitions are not acts of defining, but of wiping out. So here again, you see the important connection back to our discussion of the existence axiom and of the fact that for Galt and for Rand and for all of us, existence is identity. To be is to be something specific. And yet, the alleged higher goals that advocates of conventional morality say that they mean to achieve through sacrifice have a non-specific identity. What is this heaven? How does it deliver rewards through these magical means? Who is this God that delivers them? We don't have time today, unfortunately, to discuss Ayn Rand's philosophy of religion. I think Aaron Smith did a very good job of this on the first day of this segment of the conference, so you can look back to some of the things that he had to say there. But for sure, it's part of the problem here is a negation of causality. The requirements that to have an effect, you need to have certain causes. This is a problem not just with the religious view of the afterlife, but with the secular view of the future. How exactly is it that the dictatorship of the proletariat will bring about abundance, and that the state will wither away, and that there will be a workers' paradise? No answer is really ever given. And so all of this is really important when you're thinking about claims that there is some positive goal to be achieved by sacrifice. Galt is saying here that the only way that you can pretend that there is such a positive goal is by engaging in this kind of mystical thinking. And as I mentioned before, I think he thinks that the fact that this is a comeback, that these sorts of posits are given, heaven or the future, just keep sacrificing, we'll get something positive, reveals something important about the psychology of the people who advocate this morality, who he's now starting to call the mystics. Because remember, what is that self that they want us to sacrifice? It's the mind. And when they're asking you to believe in these higher goals, this heaven or this dictatorship of the proletariat, they're asking you to believe in it. They're asking you to believe in it without evidence, without any possible identity conditions. The world of non-identity, they posit, and it's a world of non-reward. And this, I think, is a big part of the reason why when we talk about the morality of death, it is certainly not a morality for living on earth. Because the faith that they demand of you That's a kind of mind sacrifice. Believe in what we say because we say so, even if you don't understand it, means a demand for you to surrender your mind. And as you know from yesterday's session, the mind for Galt is the main organ of human life. And it's not just a tool that I argued. It's a distinctive, essential part of human life. Remember, Galt says, to the extent that you evade, that's the extent to which you're actually negating your person. And I think this is the biggest and deepest evidence that you can give for the idea that the morality of sacrifice is a morality of death. Because to the extent that this morality demands your faith, to the extent that it demands you to accept some kind of objective that has no identity to it, it is asking for your faith. It's asking for you to surrender your mind. Your mind's your tool of survival. That's a morality of death. Now, I think there's lots of, you know, important questions you should be asking yourself when you're reading this material from Galt. Is it true that every conventional morality out there is a morality of death in this sense? Is it true that everyone who demands sacrifices can only motivate that by positing some kind of mystical realm, whether secular or religious? Certainly, many of the prominent examples that I can think of do precisely that. Have I succeeded in surveying all of the different versions of this view that there are? Do they all really ask for this? Good question. And that would be something I think I would encourage each of you to think about. Have you encountered arguments from friends, you know, for some kind of morality of sacrifice, which don't need to engage in mystical thinking to motivate their suppositions? Good question, and I encourage you to think about it. But supposing that Galt is right about this, and supposing that it is only mystical thinking that can motivate this thinking, and that's not a positive goal, that's not some positive form of wanting to live on Earth, well, what is the motivation? And he already dropped some hints about this, right? When we talked about how it's motivated by fear, but not by joy or love. And that, I think, raises important questions about, well, what is this fear of? Let me give you a short passage where he begins to explore this issue, and then we're going to elaborate on it a fair bit. No matter how eagerly you claim that the goal of your mystic wishing is a higher mode of life, which he's just dismantled, the rebellion against identity is the wish for non-existence. The desire not to be anything is the desire not to be. Now that last sentence is really important because, again, it's showing the connection between existence and identity. You can't just desire to be without desiring to be something in particular. And of course, he's argued that as a human being, the only thing that you can be is a human being. And that means accepting all of the very specific forms of activities required for human life. But why rebellion against identity? What does that mean? And why would somebody want to rebel? And here we start to get into the psychology of the mystic. It's important for Galt that these allegations about a higher mystical realm are not just sort of innocuous, incidental, wishful thinking on the part of the advocates of the morality of death. He thinks the fact that they muster these ideas, it reveals something about their deeper motivation. It shows that they're using it as a rationalization to cover for something that they don't want to accept. And here we get into the material, I think, that's especially underappreciated by a lot of readers of Galt's speech. Galt argues that these mystical theories are rationalizations that help us avoid, that help the theorists avoid really important and deep facts about life that for some reason they are uncomfortable with. It helps them to, first of all, evade the fact that cause and effect is an absolute. That, and this is an aspect of the law of identity, that real specific causes are required to bring about real effects. And there's a particular version of this that advocates of the morality of sacrifice especially want to evade. That's the fact that there are some people in the world who know this, and there are some people in the world who act on this. They're the producers. Something about those producers is offensive to the advocates of the morality of death. Something is frightening about them. What exactly? We need to figure out. But it's especially frightening to them because they themselves rely on those producers. There's different versions of forms in which they evade this fact. If we're talking about the mystics of spirit, the religionists, they'll evade their reliance on producers and their ability to discover the causes that bring about effects by saying that production is sinful. This is the old religious idea in one form or another, that it's harder for a rich man to get to heaven than it is for a camel to enter the eye of a needle, or the idea that we should emulate the lilies of the field. They neither toil, they neither reap, they don't worry about the morrow. All of, you know, you can't take it with you. What's the secular version of this, by the way? Precisely. That's exactly what I was going to say. And there's an entire philosophic apparatus that's associated with the "you didn't build that" idea. It's the idea that we don't have free will. It's the idea that the mind is nothing but matter. It's the idea that, I mean, "you didn't build that" is essentially the motto behind the philosophy of egalitarianism, in particular John Rawls, the idea that even if you work hard, even if you do, if you earn what you earn because of your work ethic and your character, well, your work ethic, that's just something that you got from your upbringing and from your genetics, and so how can you take credit for that when some people just weren't born with a good work ethic? And that's the even more explicit evasion of the producers. The in Galt's view, at least, the religious view accepts that these producers exist. It just says that what they're doing is wrong. This view says they don't even exist. And Galt's view is that this is not just, oh, these people who believe these things have just made honest mistakes because they've made mistakes in reasoning in their interpretation of the science. I mean, I'm sure there are such people, but Galt's point is they're not the ones who are pushing these ideas. He thinks that they are frightened by something, and they don't want to accept it. So I forgot to put this point up. Mystics of muscle see the mind as non-existent. That's what we were just talking about. So the big question is, why would someone be so frightened and fearful of the minds of others, of these producers, that they would erect entire theories of ethics and metaphysics just to evade that fact, just to feel comfortable that those things are not real? And I think looking at the answer to this question is going to help clarify something that we discussed briefly on the first day. There was a passage from Rourke's speech where he says, "The choice of independence versus dependence is the basic issue, but it rests upon the alternative of life and death." And a point that I raised at that time, well, how could independence versus dependence be the basic issue if it also rests on something deeper? And I think the answer is that, as you'll shortly see, the thing that it rests on more deeply is the metaphysical fact. But what's the basic issue psychologically is the choice of dependence versus independence. So this connects us to the first day. And here's the passage that I think helps do that in Galt's speech. Galt says, "A mystic is a man who surrendered his mind at its first encounter with the minds of others. Somewhere in the distant reaches of his childhood, when his own understanding of reality clashed with the assertions of others, with their arbitrary orders and contradictory demands, he gave in to so craven a fear of independence that he renounced his rational faculty." So at a certain point, mystics started out as someone like Peter Keating, who were afraid, someone who's afraid to stand up for himself, someone who's afraid to form his own judgments, and so unthinkingly accepts the conclusions of others. But that then has consequences. It means that you don't know what it is to think for yourself. And let me show you what some of the consequences of not knowing that will be. One way that you can see the motivation that Galt is getting at here is the way in which mystics, the same mystics, let's say, who've surrendered their minds in the past, now want you to surrender your mind in believing and accepting their own theories. They want your faith when they tell you that through the morality of sacrifice, you can go to heaven, or you can reach communist utopia. Why do they want your faith in believing these things? One point that Galt makes is that they fear your mind. They fear your consciousness. They don't understand how the mind works. They don't understand how it is that somebody can discover the causes that bring about effects. Why? Well, they haven't done it themselves. They haven't bothered trying to do it themselves. They see the power that you have as a sort of magical power. They're in the kind of position of a primitive savage who, like the ones that in the cargo cult, if you know that story. And Galt makes use of the imagery of savagery here. But these are savages living in a modern world. And if you read Atlas Shrugged, there's many of the looters are described as having this mentality of looking at people who have a mind as having some kind of magical power over them. You see a lot of this in the interactions with Stadler, with Reardon. And so they don't regard themselves as being able to think themselves. If you take them on faith, that gives them a sense of control over your magic. Makes them think, oh, they've got the magic too, if they can control your magic. Not only that, but I said they don't really understand how the mind works if they've not tried it themselves. But on some level, everybody knows. On some level, everybody knows how the mind works, if only from, their earliest days when they really did have to make some decisions for themselves. And everybody knows they need to use their mind on some level. And so knowing that, they're also going to feel guilty for not having chosen to think, for not having chosen to use their minds. And so if they can convince you not to use yours by accepting them on faith, well, that'll take the burden off them. That'll allow them to rationalize. Well, hey, nobody uses their minds. I shouldn't feel so guilty. Everybody's doing it. Now, for those of you who are here for Aaron Smith's talks, this should start to sound a little bit familiar. The mystics don't regard themselves as able of thinking. They do regard themselves as unworthy. They're not able. They're not worthy. What is this a sign of? They lack self-esteem, right? But one of the big points that Galt makes is that everybody needs self-esteem. Even irrational people need to convince themselves through whatever contortions of their mind that they can come up with, that they still are able and worthy. So it's not that everybody has self-esteem, but everybody needs it. And so they have to convince themselves to pretend that they have it. And that's what your faith helps them to do. When you surrender your mind, they suddenly feel like they've got the magical power, and they feel less guilty about it. And that gives them this kind of pseudo-self-esteem. That gives them not really positive motivation to move on, but it does allow them to evade the fearful things, the guilty things about themselves. And this is a big part of the reason why studying the depravity of the morality of death is important. Because if we know something about what motivates them, and we know that part of what allows them to keep going is what we give to them in the form of our faith, for instance, This has implications for how we need to act in the face of them. What happens if we give them that faith that they want? What happens if we give them that faith that they want? They feel validated. They become followers of, well, you become followers if you give them, right?
We grant them power that they can't get themselves.
Yeah.
And they keep taking more and more.
You grant them power, they keep taking more. You sanction them. Good. And we give up our own power. Now, really to fully answer this question of what happens if you give them what they want, we need to know what it is they want. And we've said a little bit about that already. We said a fair amount about it already. But we need to say, I think, just a little bit more to fully understand what happens when we give them what they want. What do they want? Well, they advocate the morality of death. We've seen that they motivate this intellectually by saying that there's some kind of mystic objective that can be achieved through it. The mystic objective doesn't have any identity, so the desire to be without the desire to be anything particular is a desire not to be, according to Galt. That plus lots more that we've now looked at leads him to this. There is only one state that fulfills the mystic's longing for infinity, non-causality, non-identity, death. No matter what unintelligible causes he ascribes to his incommunicable feelings, whoever rejects reality rejects existence, and the feelings that move him from then on are hatred for all the values of man's life and lust for all the evils that destroy it. So there's one state that fulfills this, death. This is, of course, part of what he's been saying all along by saying this is the morality of death. But what exactly is Galt saying here? Whose death is he talking about that the mystics long for? Your own, everybody's. Yeah, let's see what he says. You who are craven enough to believe that you can make terms with a mystic by giving in to his extortions, there is no way to buy him off. The bribe he wants is your life. And the monster he seeks to bribe is the hidden blank out in his mind, which drives him to kill in order not to learn that the death he desires is his own, but not just his own. They do not want to live. They want you to die. They desire nothing. They hate existence. And they keep running, each trying not to learn that the object of hatred is himself. I think this set of observations is one of the single most unappreciated sub-themes of Atlas Shrugged. Because if you ever read a popular media article saying something like, well, Ayn Rand thinks everybody's selfish, you know they haven't read Atlas Shrugged. It is most certainly not her view. She does not accept what is called psychological egoism, the idea that everybody's selfish. Not only does she not think everybody's selfish, she doesn't even think everybody wants to live. And this is a crucial point for the plot of Atlas Shrugged. I know there are a few people here who haven't read it, so I'm not going to say why it's a crucial point to the plot, but let's just put it this way. It's a crucial discovery to certain characters in the story that not everybody wants to live. And when they realize it, it changes their minds about what to do and how to live in the world. And it should have implications, I think, for all of us, too. When we realize that there are people out there who don't want to live like we do, and it's hard to accept this fact, because we do, most of us, I think, at least here in this room. So when we find this out, this is not just a self-regarding problem that those mystics have. Well, they don't want to live, leave them alone. Because, as you see, so many of the theories that they devise, so much of the faith that they demand from us, is done with the end of helping them evade the fact that they don't want to live, and helping them evade the fact that they've decided not to use their minds. If there are still people in the world, though, who do use their minds and who refuse to give that faith to them, And we'll talk more about what that means soon. That makes it even harder for them to evade. They want then to destroy those people. The best way to evade a fact is to destroy it. And the best way to destroy the fact of someone's thinking is to kill them. And that's something we have to understand when we're relating culturally to people who advocate this morality. So it has important implications for dealing with the world. I said at the end of the first talk on Rourke's speech, that one of the themes that I think is understated in The Fountainhead, to be an individualist, to be a real individualist, Rourke needs to take ideas seriously. He needs to try to understand the ideas that are moving the world so that he can associate himself with the good ones and disassociate himself from the bad ones. And this is part of what he's doing in trying to understand the principle behind the Dean. And it's part of what he needs to have an integrated self so that he doesn't just have compartmentalized knowledge and doesn't understand people's motivations and starts forming conspiracy theories about why they're out to get him. Likewise, we also need to understand the ideas moving the world for these same reasons. Because, as some of you just indicated in answer to one of my questions, the morality of death survives by support of good people. I think this is more obvious on the material front. This is something that's obvious to Reardon early on in the novel when he says, when he decides not to give his medal to the State Science Institute, for instance. Obviously, if you are providing material goods to the looters to distribute, you're helping them do that. And you're helping them build weapons against you, perhaps. What's, I think, harder for some people to see when they read Atlas and harder to practice in life is the fact that the biggest sanction, the biggest support that you can give to the looters, to the mystics, to the advocates of the morality of death is your spiritual sanction by helping them to pretend that what they want is life, by helping them to pretend that their morality is aimed at something positive, by helping them to pretend that it's anything other than death that they want. All of the thinkers who in some form or another help them do this, whether by granting the legitimacy to their codes of morality, they are helping them evade this fact. Both of these are cases of sanction of the victim. Not just the material, but especially the spiritual / intellectual form of sanction. And we need to understand this when we're dealing with people in the world who don't want to live. Think about the terrorists who say they love death like Americans love life. Can you cut deals with them in order to buy them off, if that's true? Are they even going to be ultimately deterred by military action? Or do you need more than that? And what about the egalitarians who, like we've discussed, complain that some people are getting richer even when the poor are getting better off as well? They see something threatening just by the mere perception of somebody doing better than them or better than someone else. Can you appease them by saying, well, capitalism raises all ships, when it's not really raising the ships that they care about? It's the cutting down the tall poppies. It's the fear that's really motivating them. Well, if Galt is right, and the morality of sacrifice really is a morality of death, and what these mystics really want is their own death and yours, if you give them what they want is death. And that's what they'll get. And that's what you'll get in one form or another. So how can it be stopped? How can it be stopped? Withdraw the sanction. This is Bob Newhart's sketch, comedy sketch maybe some of you have seen. And the woman comes in, tells him about her psychological problems, all the things that she does that make her life hell. He sits there listening for a few minutes and says, "You want to know what I think? Stop it! Stop it!" Now, part of the reason it's funny is because it's, of course, easier said than done. And that's true here as well. I mean, yeah, once you see what's helping them do this is your assistance, the answer is stop it. But stopping it is difficult. Here's Galt's statement about when he realized that this is what he needed to do. I saw that the enemy was an inverted morality, and that my sanction was its only power. I saw that evil was impotent, and that the only weapon of its triumph was the willingness of the good to serve it. I saw that there comes a point in the defeat of any man of virtue when his own consent is needed for evil to win. I saw that I could put an end to your outrages by pronouncing a single word in my mind. I pronounced it. The word was no. So that's stopping it. To wrap up, I want to look at the very last few paragraphs of Galt's speech and observe something about how I think people often process them. The second or third to the last paragraph in the speech is one of the most frequently quoted paragraphs in the speeches. And that's because it's beautiful. I won't read all of it here. I will read just a little part of it. Part of the reason I'm not reading all of it is because I want to say something about its context. In the name of the best within you, do not sacrifice this world to those who are its worst. Check your road and the nature of your battle. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It's possible. It's yours. And when I read the whole thing, I choke up. That's part of the other reason I didn't want to read the whole thing. But, you know, this gets quoted all over the place. You know, see it on bumper stickers. I've seen it used in primetime television. And I think that's because, you know, by itself, without the surrounding context, it's very beautiful language, but the content of it is indistinguishable from generic self-helpy power of positive thinking kind of stuff. And that's not meant as any kind of criticism of Ayn Rand, because this is not all she wrote. She also wrote the next paragraph, which never gets quoted. And this is important. Immediately after this, she says, but to win it, to win the world that's possibly yours, requires your total dedication and a total break with the world of your past, with the doctrine that man is a sacrificial animal who exists for the pleasure of others. Fight with radiant certainty and the absolute rectitude of knowing that yours is the morality of life and that yours is the battle for any achievement, any value, any grandeur, any goodness, any joy that has ever existed on earth. So I said that you really needed to understand the morality of death to know what it is that Galt is declaring moral independence from. Now I think we have a better idea of what that is and what that means. It requires this total break with the world of your past. In the novel, what this means is physically separating yourself from the society, you know, going into the gulch. Now, I also said at the beginning of our discussion of the speech that Galt's world is not ours. Galt's world is collapsing around him. People are dying everywhere. Our world is not like that. Think again about your own talk, and think about the increasing material abundance all around us. We're not living in that kind of world, and even intellectually, the thinkers of our world are not as bad as the thinkers of Galt's world. And so, and it was Rand's view, I believe, that physical separation is not necessary. But what she did think was necessary was cultural separation, breaking with the culture. And so in practice, in our world, I think what this means, especially because of the sanction, the victim issue I mentioned, is not helping people pretend that sacrifice has these higher objectives. Do embrace human existence in all of its identity. The ultimate message here is you've got to choose life on Earth. There is no other kind. Thank you.
So first of all, great talk, thank you. As you mentioned there at the beginning, there are a lot of people who got kind of a poor lot in life, the hungry, the sick, all those kind of people. Is there a way to selfishly, non-altruistically actually help them and even though we don't have any responsibility to?
Well, I mean, in some cases we might if we are friends, or or if they're loved ones of ours, we may have some responsibility. But I take your point. How do we really help them? If they deserve it, if they're in trouble through no fault of their own, there are lots of different forms it could take. It's going to depend on the situation and the context, I would think. But and it would help to think of an example that you have in mind. But there's different forms of assisting the good, just as there are different forms of assisting the evil. You don't want to do it with the evil materially or spiritually. You do want to do it with the good materially and spiritually. So if there's somebody you know who's in trouble through no fault of their own, you might want to give them some money. But as with evil, the spiritual intellectual issue is the more important one. You can give people better ideas for how to function in this world. You can understand the fact that if they're good, the world around them is demanding unnecessary, it's demanding their faith and their sacrifice as well. And you can empower them to not give that sanction. Something that Yaron and Ankar have emphasized a lot in the last few years is that when you're making arguments about capitalism, for instance, it's fine thing to say that capitalism helps the poor. Not all the poor, though, right? It doesn't help the undeserving poor. It doesn't help people who are in trouble through some fault of their own, people who are lazy or complacent, or who want to keep the same job they've had for 40 years and are worried about immigrants taking it or something like that. That capitalism, free trade, is not going to help those people, but it will help the people who deserve it, the people who are trying to get ahead in life. And those people are the greatest victims of the regulations that stop them from advancing. I'm not sure if that's what you were getting at, but that's my first reaction.
I'm thinking more specifically like those who are so permanently disabled, they're unable to work, things of that nature, but yet might have an objectivist type spirit.
I mean, such people exist, and when there's... they're either the ones who can contribute something and the ones who can't, and the ones who can't contribute something can't, and they have to rely on charity, and they have in ages where the greatest, such an abundance was produced that an overflowing of it enabled them to do that. But in our age, there's so many ways even people who are physically disabled can contribute with their minds, and we need, and capitalism and technology have figured out ways to do that.
So I know you could have a whole talk about this, or even a whole course, but can you point to me some of the ways ecologism fits into the morality of death?
Ecology?
Yeah.
If you mean ecological philosophy, environmentalism, then it is definitely a version of it, insofar as if you look at the intellectual leadership of the environmental movement, they are not motivated by clean air and clean water. They are instead motivated by bashing capitalism, science, and technology. And these are all indispensable tools of life, and so they're against life. Now, there's a challenge, I think, in working out the difference between the people who call themselves environmentalists, who are really like that, and the ones who really are concerned with cleaning things up. And it's a tough call how many there are of each type. And when you encounter somebody who says they're an environmentalist, you have to ask a lot of questions to find out. And in many cases, there isn't a clear answer because the person's mixed and they're confused about things. And they maybe have some elements of hatred of the good in them, and they have some elements of just really wanting to clean things up. But I definitely think that for some people who call themselves environmentalists, and for the for the ideology of environmentalism as such, it is like egalitarianism, a case of this morality of death. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk, Ben. I appreciate it. It's the first time I've heard mind identified as an organ, and I was wondering if you could kind of explain that a little bit.
That was my word. I don't think it appears in in the speech as such. Part of the reason that I chose it was because I first wanted to say the mind is a tool of survival, which is also true, but I was thinking about the point that I was urging on the previous day about how the use of rationality is not simply a means to the end of human life, but that it constitutes part of the end of human life. And so I thought, well, organ is a good word that has more of that connotation. You know, if you rip someone's organ out of their body, like if you rip a brain out of their body, that's not just taking away a tool, right? It's taking away a big chunk of you. That's part of the reason I use the word organ.
Ben, I was wondering if you think there is a value in making the distinction between faith and fantasy. Most of the time, those are synonymous. But I'm thinking of faith as something I don't know the answer to yet. It's usually used that faith is something in principle you can't know, and you just have to accept it. And if that distinction isn't useful, if I'm being clear here at all, what kind of a concept or a word would you use for something that you don't know yet, but you have a belief, a motivation to pursue?
Okay, so I think it's really important to use the word faith in a sense that clearly distinguishes it from the concept of reason, because there's a real fundamental choice to be made there. The word is used in lots of other ways that don't necessarily imply a distinction from reason. So for instance, sometimes people will say, you know, I'm taking it on faith from my friend that the way to get to the gas station is to go two blocks down, take a left. Sometimes people use the word just to mean beliefs, knowledge that they get from other people. It's not a great usage, but when used that way, it's innocent. But it's like all the debates we can get into about how to use selfish as a concept. Some say that there are good senses, some say there are bad senses. I think it's important to distinguish faith from reason for the same kinds of reasons it's important to distinguish selfish from selfless. There's a real fundamental choice there to be made in regards to how you govern your thinking and how you govern your life for selfish versus selfless. And so there are plenty of different words we can use to talk about the things that are sometimes called faith that are innocent, like you have confidence in something, you have a hunch about something, and it's going to depend on the particular situation and what you're thinking about. You have a hypothesis that you want to test. Maybe you've got a little bit of evidence. Sometimes the things that people think that they don't have any reason for and are just taking on faith, they really do have a reason for it. They just haven't articulated it. Because sometimes the evidence can be, you know, just a really tiny amount of evidence. A lot of, I think, you know, when detectives and cops on TV shows talk about, I've got it and feel it in my gut that this is true. They really do have some evidence. It's just that it isn't proof yet.
They say it listens. You know, it just you hear it, and there's nothing obvious that says no. So I'm going to pursue that.
Right. Yeah. But there's something that they have that's letting them think that when it's rational. So I wouldn't call that faith.
Thanks for the talk. One thing that blew me away about Ayn Rand from the start was she keeps asking why. You know, she doesn't just say, you know, that's how life is, you know, that's the way it is. You know, she keeps asking why and why. And coming back to your point on, you know, mystics of muscle and mystics of spirit promising eternal happiness in some other life, I fear this is some kind of a rhetorical question, really. I mean, you know, the mystics, they keep saying, you know, it's evil to be happy here on earth, right? Don't, you know, sex is sin and material production, all of that. Happiness here on earth is forbidden. But why is it okay in the other world to be happy? You know, why is it okay in heaven to be happy forever and ever and ever? Has there ever been some argument brought forth, because it's confusing, you see, it just doesn't make sense to me.
It's a good question, and one thing that it reminds me of is a similar question that Galt asks in a different place in the speech when he's considering what looks like a contradiction in the idea of altruism. he says, why is it wrong for you to benefit from your own actions, but not wrong for somebody else to, right? It sounds like a contradiction. But his point there is not to say, oh, this is a contradiction, I've refuted you. His point is to say, at a deeper level, there isn't a contradiction, because the logic of the position is that it's not okay for you to benefit because you've earned it. It is okay for others to benefit because they haven't, because they lack this value. And I think that something similar is going to answer your question about heaven. That is, yeah, it's okay to talk about some kind of reward when this reward has no discernible identity, if it's the kind that allows you, that you can think about only by surrendering your mind. And that's the equivalent, I think, of these people benefiting materially because they have no value.
A quick question about looking for resources. So studying objectivism, living by it, is obviously incredibly difficult for not rational but very real reasons. And I'm wondering if there's, in terms of like turning your back on all the things that aren't objective, if there are places to go that can help you do that. Like if you're trying to learn how to do a backflip, it's extremely difficult, it's scary, but you know exactly what you need to do. But if you just had people there that could help like get you over the hump, that's there. I feel like there's a lot of learning, like how, like what it means to be objective, and I'm looking for places to go to like help do those things.
But you came to the right place. No, I'm serious. I mean, not my class, but although it helps. I mean, places like this conference. And I say that not out of completely shameless promotion of the Institute, but because when you gather together with people who share these values, that makes them psychologically real to you in a way that simply studying texts won't. It gives you real people that you can get to know and live up to and emulate. And I should say, I think there's so much wonderful, there's so many wonderful things that have resulted from the technology of the internet and your ability to learn on the internet about these ideas. And I'm super pleased that more and more material from Ayn Rand is going up. But nothing on the internet is a substitute for getting to live and interact with real people. And that's not just about going to conferences. It's about finding people where you live who share these values in whatever form that you can socialize with, that you can learn with, that you can trade with. And so to whatever extent you can find people in your area who are interested in pursuing these same paths in life, find them.
Anything other than OCON and local groups come to mind?
Whatever you can make for yourself.
We got about 2 minutes left and probably 10 more questions, but stick around after.
Thank you, Ben. Don't you think that the fact that our world is much better probably than Galt's is the thing that maybe keeps their ideals alive? Because sometimes it seems that we have to say, like, what if we live for God? And that is like the only way to show them, maybe just say, stop producing, stop doing things, and to show them. And how do we do not to get to an extreme to show them that if we live for God and not for us, and if we are not selfish, and that life is not just possible? So my question is, how do we show them without getting to an extreme?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by showing them without getting to an extreme. Are you saying something like, how do we show them without withdrawing from society? And
yeah, like maybe like God did.
Right.
Like if we live for God and just stop producing, people are going to starve. We are
right.
not going to
okay.
have like nothing.
Right. So I suggest taking a look at two essays by Ayn Rand on this. Actually, mainly just one. Take a look at her essay, How Does One Live a Rational Life in an Irrational Society? Because one of the things that she makes clear there is the enduring importance of moral judgment. And there's a lot of different ways to approach this. You know, you don't have to withdraw from society to demonstrate to the world what your values are. Sometimes a simple "I don't agree" is enough, and sometimes more than that is even better. Explaining yourself. We had a wonderful discussion the other night. I don't see many students here, but the Strive group had a wonderful discussion about what it's like to live on a college campus today and to feel alienated from your culture because of it, and ways to interact with people that are productive, and ways to benefit from stating your judgments of people, productive ways of doing that, where you're not necessarily alienating people from you, but where you're opening yourself up to more and better conversations with people, putting your values out there so that you've clearly defined the terms of your interaction with the world can yield so many surprising benefits it's hard to estimate. Yes, it also causes awkwardness, and it causes sometimes to lose friendships and opportunities, but then you often discover these are maybe friendships and opportunities you didn't want in the first place, and you're glad that you made that clear so that they didn't happen. I don't think anybody recorded that discussion, unfortunately, but if you find Dr. Salmieri or Dr. Gorlin, they'll tell you more about it.
That's time. Great job.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to aynrand.org.